Hi and welcome back. This is episode number 257. Today I'm joined by Mark Webster, the co-founder of Authority Hacker. This is not only a leading SEO website, but it's also now a major community and becoming a movement. Mark is also the co-host of a podcast, which of course is similarly named the Authority Hacker Podcast. As well as this endeavor, they are almost media moguls now as they own and build a number of significant websites out there on the internet. So we're going to learn about that today. The reason why I got Mark on the podcast is to discuss his experience with outsourcing, his wisdom in terms of implementation of outsourcing and getting his teams to run smoothly through process management. And of course, you know, I delve into why outsourcing is so big in the online community and how they are really early adopters of this remote work, globalized employment, and outsourcing generally. So I'm super excited to discuss it with Mark, and I'm sure you will enjoy this as well. If you want any of the show notes, then go to outsourceaccelerator.com/257. This podcast is brought to you by Payoneer, the leading global B2B payment solution for the outsourcing industry. If you're a BPO or freelancer or have outsourced staffing, then Payoneer makes sending and receiving international payments super simple, quick, secure, and of course, low cost. They have some fantastic features which have been designed specifically for the needs of this industry. You can easily manage payments between your clients, staff and suppliers across multiple currencies and international bank accounts. Payoneer help make outsourcing easy, so consider them now. And if your BPO, clients or suppliers aren't already using Payoneer, then ask them why not. For a limited time, Payoneer is offering a $50 bonus if you sign up now. So go to register.payoneer.com/OA. Or go to our website and we will have links there. Hi and welcome back, everybody. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Mark Webster, who is one of the co-founders of Authority Hacker. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on today.
Absolute pleasure. And so we're sort of, the worlds are clashing, I think, in this podcast, potentially. A lot of our audience is either in outsourcing or in the small and medium-sized business sectors, and maybe more, a little bit more traditional than the businesses that Mark is used to dealing with. And I got Mark on the podcast because I want to share his experiences of the online world that he's deeply immersed into, and you know, to explore how the online world generally is very much an early adopter of the future of work, which is remote-based work, which is a lot of outsourcing, and also the gig economy. So, Mark, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us.
Excellent. Looking forward to this one. I've got a lot to say on this, I think.
Fantastic. Let's see where it takes us. So, Mark, initially, can you introduce yourself in terms of kind of what you do and maybe how you would introduce yourself if you were in a bar? And considering that maybe people aren't so up to speed with some of the kind of online magic that you do on a day-to-day basis, how would you explain it to the average Joe?
Okay, so my name is Mark Webster. I'm the co-founder of Authority Hacker. Authority Hacker is a website where we teach people how to do all aspects of online marketing. So that's anything from the beginner who's never done it before, who wants to learn how to rank their website in Google, through to, you know, very advanced topics, conversion rate optimization, advanced on-page SEO, link building, these kinds of things. So we sell training courses to teach this. That's our business model. And we also make money from doing reviews and through affiliate marketing as well. In addition to that, we run a portfolio of authority websites. So those are kind of like larger websites focusing on specific topic areas. We employ teams of writers, content creators, editors, graphic designers, and everything else you can imagine in between who would potentially work on a website across different fields. Our business is entirely remote, so we have no fixed office. And the majority of our employees are members of staff are sort of freelancers from the gig economy. And it's just sort of interesting what you said about the future of work. I just want to sort of say, like, for me, that is very much the present of work, that we are living, breathing that kind of reality right now. And we have been for several years now.
Yeah. And it is incredible how the kind of world evolves. And I don't think that it kind of officially does, but then you kind of look back and as things evolve over the last kind of 10, 20, 30 years, you suddenly realize that, you know, now a sort of critical mass of people are working incredibly different to how they would have been working if this whole technology thing didn't happen. So for those that are sort of that need a little bit more background, what is authority science? And you're effectively an old school publisher within the new world, and you don't need printing presses, but you've built out the entire infrastructure. Yeah?
Absolutely. So the way I explain it to my aunt, who she has an iPad now, but she doesn't have an email address. She's never been tech savvy. She's never used a computer. The way I explain it to her is exactly like that. We are like a modern version of a magazine, where we get together a lot of content creators, designers, publishers, just any kind of content which would be of value. And then we sell that, or we give that away for free to people. And then we sell advertising, or we make money by selling other things within that content. So that's kind of the business model, if you had to compare it to a kind of old school business structure.
Absolutely. And this whole thing, do you think it really sprung? Now, obviously, this is the new media. And of course, it's being facilitated by everything going online. And largely, a lot of the rule sets and publishing kind of, I suppose, protocols that you work to are then guided by Google, because Google's the kind of overseeing lord of this whole kind of online game. Where do you see yourself in terms of a publisher for the sake of publishing versus kind of building a structure to appease the Google beast?
Yeah, so I mean, there are kind of two approaches you can take mentally to this. The first is you can build a structure to appease the Google beast. And I think in the early days of what we were doing, we were very much trying to do that. And any kind of trick or hack we could identify that would sort of game the system, we were kind of there trying it out. This was from our previous business, which was a digital marketing agency where we worked for clients that did more or less the same kind of activities, but just for other people. And then that actually didn't go so well. There were a number of successive Google updates, and we got hit pretty hard in the first one. It was called Google Penguin, and it targeted certain kinds of link building, which is a tactic for search engine optimization. And so we kind of decided that was a wake-up call. We needed to change our approach, and we wanted to work very much within the terms of service of Google and kind of work with it rather than against it. But as a consequence of that, the way to do that is actually to think of yourself more as a publisher, and like think of the user first, think of the audience first. How can we make what we're doing better? How can we improve our quality and those kinds of things? And as you do that, just naturally, you will then be doing a lot of the things which are right for Google and to rank in the search engines, other search engines as well. So it's not kind of like a binary thing. It's not always one way or the other. There's definitely like an overlap between the two schools of thought. But that's kind of how ours has evolved over the years.
Incredible. And how old would you say this industry is? The industry, and what do you call it? Is it just generally online work?
I would call it online marketing. That's kind of the commonly held term for it. It's old. I mean, when I was getting into it in 2009, so that's 10 years ago, people were saying, "Oh, it's dead. You know, it's time to move on. Time to find something else." And people still say that at the moment. It's not true. It's never been growing more, and it's crazy right now. Actually, the potential and the direction it's going in, but people have been doing this for 20 odd years. I will say it's gotten a lot more mature in the last 5 years. There's been a lot more bigger players entering the space. You had big acquisitions like the New York Times bought the wirecutter.com for $30 million. That was quite a big one. And there have been many others as well. Big kind of traditional publishers are kind of realizing that their business model is not really going to hack it over the next 20 years. And so they're starting to transition into kind of the online marketing space. They're either by acquisitions or just by changing the direction of their own site in certain ways in order to kind of stay relevant and adapt to the kind of current market conditions.
Yeah, it's incredible to see this whole kind of, because media has always been an incredibly powerful and highly developed industry because of the power that it can potentially wield. And it seems that over the last kind of 10 to 20 years, it's really been eaten away by the masses of the small guys just creating their own content, which is incredible, really, isn't it? It's sort of seeing the full evolutionary cycle of things that has either been, I suppose, facilitated or certainly enabled by technology. Something that also happened 10 years ago was Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week. And I, you know, with the online community, you've got the remote workers, the digital nomads, and I think to some degree, the Tim Ferriss book kind of really opened up that whole world of the combination of both freeing yourself from the daily grind, but then also utilizing kind of a global workforce. Where it's cheaper, but also on a remote basis, so people aren't kind of so fixed in terms of hours and the place of work. Did that have a big influence on you and also the industry that you're in, do you think?
Absolutely. So I remember when I finished university, I had a job in an insurance company for a couple of years. I hated it. So I quit. I moved to Thailand to become a scuba diving instructor because why not? I spent way too much money there on diving equipment and partying, so I ran out of money. So then I went to Australia to become a wheat farmer for 6 months to, on my working holiday visa, basically make a lot of money in a short space of time as a poor backpacker. In that tractor, I remember I was working 16-hour days just driving around fields, and then I listened to the 4-hour work week in a day. And it was, yeah, it was absolutely life-changing. I can't emphasize enough how much of an impact that book had on me. And I know there's many other successful people in our space who also kind of echo that. I think it does get a lot of stick sometimes nowadays, looking back sort of 10 years in, you know, how realistic is working 4 hours a week? If you really want to be successful, that's maybe debatable. But as you said, the eye-opening effect that it had in terms of simple ideas like calculating how much your 1 hour of your time is worth, and then anything which you can outsource for cheaper than that, you should. That's one of the principles he talks about in the book. It's not always practical to do that, but just thinking about it in those terms, I think certainly for me and my businesses has sort of pushed me to outsource a lot more and to look at kind of where I can provide the most value in the business and where I can kind of have other people to help in certain tasks. So it's been absolutely phenomenal book, and it fundamentally changed, I think, our industry completely, and also brought a lot more people into the space who perhaps wouldn't have otherwise discovered it, which I think is a great thing.
And it's an incredible time because I was doing my backpacking thing around the turn of the whatever millennium in 2000. And back then there was not you couldn't access online work. You know, I remember us going into internet cafes maybe twice a week to check emails. You know, 20 years ago, there wasn't as many people on email. But 2008, you know, you had the global financial crisis. I think a lot of people were put out of work and then looking for new careers, and this whole online work then became available. And Tim Ferriss came out with his book. And I think it was this kind of heady mix of just people, you know, kind of changing what they're doing. And you see a lot of these startups, these big, big successful unicorns now, a lot of them really started around 2008, 2009, didn't they? It was quite an interesting period.
Yeah. Whenever there's a big shakeup of the economy, that, you know, there are those who kind of put their heads in the sand and think, oh, the world is ending, this is terrible. And then, as we've seen, there are those who think, okay, something's fundamentally changed here. How can we take advantage of this? What can we do here? And, you know, big platforms, like Upwork or formerly Odesk, I think started around that time. I used to work on there myself in the early days, actually. It's also a lot of kind of structural things. So that was the sort of time that 3G data started to become a thing that people had, and that laptops became kind of good enough that you could realistically work on it. You didn't need a desktop computer to do these kinds of work. The latest MacBook at the time was actually pretty decent. So there are other things going on there as well, but certainly, yeah, it was an interesting time.
And so that, you know, I think that was really the beginning of this big movement of the digital nomads and online workers. And you've now got this sort of populist remote working movement, even in the big cities. And I think there are pros and cons to that. Now, my angle is that outsourcing is fantastic, which is generally the leveraging of cheaper salaries within cheaper economies. But my angle is that, you know, it's maybe better to have everyone centralized within an office. Yet, of course, you know, there's now different, approaches and a lot of different ways to skin different cats. Can you explain to people your structure of how you work and how you build an enterprise or a business based on remote working and kind of how everything clicks together?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a kind of fundamental value of our business that we would have a remote company, a fully remote company. So no fixed office anywhere in the world. The entire team works from home or works from co-working spaces rather. And then we all collaborate online. We use technology such as Slack, Asana, Google Drive, Google Sheets, these kinds of tools to do our work together. And so that was kind of how we fundamentally set it up. That was born largely out of my frustration, really, at the office environments I'd been in the past, both in the corporate world and in my very first company, where we sort of followed the corporate way to an extent. And to be honest with you, having an office is expensive. It is often not nearly as productive as people make it out to be. And it actually, in my experience, it breeds an element of kind of laziness and a lack of true ownership. What I mean by that is that the typical example of you want to kind of coach someone or show someone how to do something. It's very easy in an office just to wheel your chair over and sort of point the screen out. And then if you haven't kind of explained it properly the first time, they can just, you know, turn around and ask you a question. And the communication flow is very easy there. Now, you might think that that's a good thing. And in some cases, you'd be right. However, as a consequence of this, you will also find that you are increasingly not thinking through how you are explaining things very clearly. So, for example, when I need to teach someone how to do something in my company, there's a couple ways. I can either have a call with them where we do some kind of screencast, screen sharing, webcam setup. I can do an audio call. I can write them an email. I can write them a message on Slack, or I can record a video, like a screencast video. So there's all these different options depending on the circumstance. But for all of them, I'm going to have to think about how I want to really communicate what I'm trying to get across to this person. And just having that kind of extra requirement, extra onus to have me really think about it, because it's not easy for them to turn around and just ask me later in the day. That I feel has really made us better communicators and made us a lot more clear about what we want and what we expect from our team. So that's been a really interesting kind of soft benefit from outsourcing. Of course, as you mentioned, the price is obviously a huge thing. I mean, you're able to hire people all over the world and kind of arbitrage the costs. And many people think that this often comes as a result of kind of lower quality work or sort of inferior output. Well, my experience is the opposite. Because you're recruiting from a bigger potential talent pool, If your recruitment systems and processes are solid and you know what you're doing, then you are able to find even better people than you otherwise would have had in your kind of local area, just because your potential talent pool is so much bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, and with outsourcing and remote work, I think there's a balance, really, isn't there, between the friction caused by not being in the same environment versus the benefits you get from it, which are intangible or productivity based, and then also the cost benefits. And it's kind of a mixture of those, which will depend from organization to organization as well. Would you see yourself ever centralizing if you reach 100 staff or if you get to a point, or do you see that these efficiencies can scale ad infinitum?
They can scale forever. And I think more and more organizations will start giving up their offices and will start going in this direction. Right now, the main kind of way they can justify it to their kind of board is cost, because that's easy to quantify. But as more companies start to actually do it, they will see that productivity increases, worker satisfaction increases, of course, cost decreases, and just everybody is happier in these kinds of in environments, at least in my experience. I look to some of the larger organizations who have the kind of full virtual team. I think TopTal is probably one of the biggest, certainly, and they are, you know, many, many, many times the size of us, and they still manage to do it very effectively.
Yeah, and automatic, of course, like WordPress, they're sort of renowned for it, aren't they? How do you find the whole? Yeah, go on.
Sorry, I was just going to add that we also actually got an office. I think it was like 3 years ago. To be honest with you, it was because we forgot all of the bad things, and we thought, oh, we're growing a lot now. We're going to hire a lot of people. Let's get an office. We had that office for 6 weeks before we realized, okay, this is a terrible idea. And then we found a replacement tenant, and we got out of that as soon as we could. And we actually recorded a podcast, myself and Gail, my business partner, immediately after that with our thoughts. And we said to ourselves, if you ever think about renting an office again, we have to re-listen to us in that podcast. So we remember.
Wow, incredible. And what do you say? Okay, so I've got a couple of devil's advocate comebacks. You know, recently I was in New York selling the dream of outsourcing, which is an incredible opportunity. Even in New York, you know, there's 20 million people, which is a big employment pool. But as you say, there's 7 billion people out there. And when you compare the 20 million to 7 billion, the world market is just so much bigger. And then, of course, there's cost savings, and, you know, there's a number of benefits. But one of the most common comebacks people said is, how do you know they're working? You know, and it's incredible, really, because it's a sophisticated city, bright business people, but when they're just not used to this new kind of, I suppose, structure of work, the almost elementary questions come back into play. But something to take that a little bit further, you know, I'm a fit guy, I'm highly disciplined, but I can very rarely, or basically never, work out at home. I need to go to the gym to have the motivation. Do you find that, you know, you're a motivated guy, you're driven by your business, you're no doubt excited by it, but what about the millennial, the kids hanging out in Chiang Mai? Do you sort of see that they're at peak productivity when they're kind of hanging out by themselves during the day?
This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
No, this is a really interesting question, because a lot of people, when they, if that's your first question, how do you know they're actually working? I tend to think that either the organization culture they're in or the people they have working for them might not necessarily be the best they can realistically achieve. It's very easy in an office environment to think that people are working, but I've worked in an office for several years, and when people don't want to work, they don't work. They just have to pretend that they're working, or, you know, there's all these people who stay in and leave 5 minutes after the boss leaves, put in the hours just to show that they're apparently working. It always baffled me why people do that. I mean, I get it. Don't get me wrong. This is kind of like keeping up appearances and all that. But I'm a very, I guess, pragmatic kind of guy. And it always just felt stupid that kind of setup was going on. So I guess for me, the in the outsource kind of environment, whether people are working, you know, the 8 hour day or the 9 hour day, whatever your shift is not just not important. It's all about the output. And if someone wants to, you know, put their tools down and go and play their Xbox for an hour in the middle of the day, just because they ran out of steam, then that's fine. Look, I don't think there's too many people in this world who can work an 8 hour day and have eight solid, deep work, productive hours in it. You're going to have peaks and troughs. It's going to ebb and flow. When you're in the office environment and you're just not in the zone, you've nowhere to chill out. You've nowhere to kind of relax and recoup and just take a bit of downtime. When you're at home, you can do all that. So when you show up, you're bringing your A game, and you're over delivering. Now, that's not to say that there aren't going to be a small percentage of people who are just going to kind of like milk the system and do as little as possible. But I find that those people tend to actually prefer working in office environments, because it's easier for them to kind of get away with stuff, not because they're kind of hidden in plain sight, but because you're in a remote setup with a virtual team, then, you know, you're going to be checking up on people more often. We use a number of software tools, Asana being one of them, to kind of record what the tasks people are working on. The way we structure our organization, we have weekly goal setting and review calls with every manager with their aligned reports. So we track whether goals are being hit over time. We work together to set objectives for the week. If you're doing all those kinds of stuff, which you should be doing in any organization, then it's really difficult to kind of pretend that you're working, or to kind of like not be there. And if it's, you know, some of the more typical outsourced roles, such as customer support, for example, most of the software these days keeps very, very detailed metrics about the average time to respond and how long it takes to type a response and all these kind of things. So the technology is more than there to kind of solve this problem. But I think fundamentally it's kind of like an organizational and a people problem. If you're having these kinds of issues.
Yeah, it seems like the recognition of work needs to change, doesn't it, from the old school time to the productivity and output. And I suppose the complication there is that, you know, everyone can put in 8 hours, and it's standard across whatever profession you're working in. Whereas when you're dealing with an output, it differs literally for every job, every role, every person. A big part of what you said before is, you know, when people aren't sitting beside you, you then had to rethink your own processes. And, you know, whether you're doing screen sharing, whether you're creating videos, whether you have SOPs, you know, so as we all build businesses, we're learning a huge amount as we build, but how much of your journey has been about learning how to manage your team better, building better processes, mapping better, and, you know, building stronger SOPs so that everyone's on the same page? What sort of journey have you been through with that?
That is my journey. That's like kind of that is the essence of building a business. A lot of people who have not started a business think that the business is all about the idea. But actually, it's all about the execution of an idea. And there are many ideas out there. There are very few people who truly innovate with their ideas. Most things sort of build on other ideas. In terms of the organizational stuff, which you mentioned, when we first started, if I look back on it now, it was absolute chaos. I mean, we had no structure. We didn't really know what we were doing. We had no idea kind of how to organize our work, even individually, let alone for the people we started hiring in the early days. And so, you know, a lot of that was just making colossal mistakes and kind of learning these things. And then as time went on, and certainly nowadays, there's really a lot of good information out there about kind of how to manage your team, how to hire the right people, how to structure your work environment, these kinds of things. I remember, for example, I on my podcast, I actually interviewed a guy, Nigel. He used to run a technology company in Australia, and he was telling me about his SOP setup and how his business had over 1,000 of them and all that. And the way he was describing it, it was kind of like a bit of a revelation for me. Why haven't we been doing this before? That, of course, that makes perfect sense. Everyone should be doing this. And then since that point on, we've worked really hard, and we've built SOPs ourselves. We sort of adopted the approach at any one point you should either be working from, editing, or creating an SOP. And if you're not doing one of those three things without a good reason, there's potentially a problem. It's a tool rather than a rule, but it kind of gives you a kind of methodology about these things to think of. As we've grown as an organization, having this structure in place it's enabled us to do really the work of maybe an organization five times the size of ours with far fewer people, just because everyone knows what they have to do. It's very clear. Mistakes are minimized. If there is a mistake, we identify it. We look at the process. We decide if we want to edit or change the process, and we fix it. And generally, it doesn't kind of repeat again. This is just this kind of stuff. If you want to grow your business, you can get to six figures, mid six figures a year with just yourself or a couple people, and you don't have to do any of this stuff, and it's going to be messy. And that's what a small business is. But if you want to get to seven figures a year, eight figures per year, look at what those companies are doing. Look at what the organizations at that level are doing. And they all have this stuff really, really sorted out. And that is one of the key differentiators between a successful small medium business and one that's going nowhere.
Yeah, it's fundamentally scalable at that point, isn't it? You know, if you have things mapped down and things are out of your head and on paper in front of you, then there's no limit really to the size of that business. Whereas if it's contained within someone's head, the founder or the key person, it's really not going anywhere, and it's probably not that well organized. The Philippines as well is renowned, and the whole industry here, which is the single biggest industry in the Philippines, is called the business process outsourcing, or BPO. And, it's ironic that the whole thing is based around business processes. And you get a lot of businesses coming over here, whether they're entrepreneurs or more corporate enterprise, thinking that they're going to come to the developing nation, which is the Philippines, and show them how work is properly done. And then they're just blown away by the level of sophistication of process mapping and process development, because this country has been doing it for 25 years. It's now got incredible executive depth in terms of managing these and optimizing these, and it can really blow companies away just in terms of the level of sophistication. And also what we find is that people can come over here with a big but relatively immature company, and it takes the process of outsourcing to basically map out their company, which takes them to the next level of maturity. It internationalizes them, it creates proper structures, proper departments, and then they can take their company to the next level. So it's, they're not only saving money, they're getting sort of a higher quality of delivery, and they're then also able to take their company to the next level. So it's super important, isn't it, to get these processes mapped.
Also, if you ever want to sell your business, if you're kind of still working in the business, it's going to be difficult, or they're going to, if you can't even sell it at that point, you're going to have to stick around for potentially years transitioning it. But if you've built it to run, to operate without you, because your SOPs and your systems process are all on point, then that period is can be very, very small. So that's also worth considering if you're a business owner as well.
Absolutely. And now, one of the other concerns about outsourcing and the globalized economy is, of course, the culture and the friction in terms of language, cultural alignment, both internally, how co-workers are all going to work together, but also possibly in your industry. It's really critical because you're a publisher, you're creating content, and it's got to be on target in terms of the sound and tone and obviously the grammar and the basics. How have you found the differences working across different cultures, different languages, and how do you manage those aspects?
First of all, I think people maybe put more emphasis on spelling and grammar and these kinds of things than is actually kind of necessary these days. When you're producing an old school newspaper or magazine, writing your college thesis, I get it. It has to be perfect. But the fact is, my business partner, my co-founder, he's French. That's his first language. His English is very, very, very good. However, it's in the early days, and even today, it's not 100% perfect. Like, I read it, and I know it's quite obvious to me it's not written by a native English speaker. Not to knock him or anything, but we've published a lot of this work, and people read it, people like it, people accept it. That's kind of fine. So the first thing I would say around this is there's the threshold of what you can get away with these days is probably a lot higher, especially on the web. People don't expect kind of like perfect grammar. You can get away with it a little bit. In terms of the question though about different countries and the cross-cultural stuff, I guess I've been fortunate to work around the world in many countries sort of in my earlier days. So I guess I was a little bit more used to just kind of being in that adaption mode. And it hasn't really been too big of a deal for me in kind of understanding something which might frustrate me. Typically was kind of like just how things are in this country or a certain part of the world. So you do definitely have to keep an open mind about it. But there's usually things that you can kind of learn from other countries, because there'll be certain things which you do in your own country, wherever that's from, which might not necessarily be the most optimal way to do something or to think about stuff. So I think the real important thing is just to keep an open mind. And then my experience has just been that good people exist in every single country and every single culture around the world. The percentage of high quality A player employees is about the same everywhere. So it's more about like finding those people rather than necessarily finding people who align or whose way of thoughts align exactly with your own. It's good to have a bit of diversity kind of in there as well from a thinking perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, if you're increasing the potential pool that you're choosing from, you've got greater chance of finding those A players, and this, instead of just geographically constraining yourself to one town. Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, the range of people you can hire on anywhere, within an hour or something of putting a job ad up, it's incredible that you can do that, and the opportunity that affords you to affordably bring in talent to work in so many different areas of your business. Just it's crazy. I mean, we couldn't do what we're doing without that capability.
And so, you know, to maybe round this off, where is all of this going, Mark? Where is the future of all this? You know, and coming back to the beginning of the conversation, I see the online economy being one of the most advanced and early adopters in terms of remote and the digital nomads and things like that. Yet, you know, you go back to New York, you go back to London, and most people are still stuck to their desks and can't even really grasp what outsourcing is or what the global employment pool is. So there's two incredible sort of very disparate methodologies to running a business at the moment. Where do you see this in the next 10 to 20 years? Is everyone going to be working online remotely all around the world?
No, I mean, I think we're quite far away from everyone in the world being remote. I think there's probably some more technological change needs to occur before we're truly at that level. I'm thinking some kind of virtual reality office here. I don't know. But it's clearly going in the outsource direction. I mean, you say that a lot of people still sort of tied to their desks in kind of London and New York, these kind of places. That's certainly true. Based on the people I know who work there, there are still, you know, layoffs and kind of more outsourcing projects on the go. I think where we're at right now in the economy is that there's actually like a little bit of a shortage of labor, it seems, in certainly in the UK. I'm not sure how things are over in the US. But there's a bit of a shortage of labor. So, you know, no one's kind of getting outsourced or getting pushed out of a job there just because salaries are kind of going up and there's huge, huge demand for people at the moment. I think where this like real risk can kind of come in is not necessarily in outsourcing, but more in like automation. So things like driverless cars and these kinds of things, I think when they do come in, they will have a much more profound impact on the kind of work economy than in terms of it will be like a bit of a cliff edge. Versus I think with outsourcing, yes, it's taken some jobs, you know, the typical call center you imagine being outsourced to India or something like that. I know my previous company had a lot of projects like that. So you might think in terms of that being outsourcing, but another way of looking at it is it's like an enabler. So it's enabled me to start a business and hire, you know, 20 odd people around the world and create all this economic activity. And so many other people are able to do that as well. So maybe it's actually like a, you know, more a creator of enterprise, certainly in the kind of online marketing web space. Whereas before, for me to, you know, open an office in London and hire, you know, a developer, a designer, a writer, you know, we're talking, you know, six-figure startup fees. There's no way I could have done that. I think it's much easier to take the bootstrapped approach to growing your business with cheaper outsourcing models like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the irony, isn't it? You know, outsourcing has been around for a long time now. Automation has been around for a long time now. Software, which is also taking a lot of jobs. Yet employment is in sort of most of the biggest economies, some of the lowest it's ever been. And unemployment is the lowest. And unemployment in a lot of places now is getting so critical that businesses are actually having to close down. In Japan, some companies are just declaring bankruptcy because they can't find staff. So it's incredible. And outsourcing is this release valve because, again, it just enables you to tap into the pool of 7 billion people that are on the planet. It's an interesting thing that's on the horizon.
It's also showing that people, the companies, organizations are going to have to do more to meet the needs of their employees. I'm not talking about just paying them more, although they're clearly going to have to do that. But things like work-life balance, like, you know, having more time off, vacation days, these kinds of things. I mean, the fact that in the US, the average employee gets, what is it, like 11 days vacation a year? It baffles me why anyone would put up with that. Because there are, you know, thousands of companies online around the world who will give you 2-3 times that much, no, as much as that, no problem. So I think those kind of that side of things will also be changed or influenced a lot by the outsourcing movement as well. And so we might actually end up in this state where there's a kind of more, it's not like a fixed office onshore company and then a fully remote outsourced company, but more both of them being operating in a kind of hybrid model and more people doing, you know, month-long maybe travel while I'm working thing, or, you know, work from home 3 days a week, you know, these kinds of models evolving over time. I think it could go in that direction.
And there's going to be a leveler somewhere, isn't there? Because as you become one globalized workforce, I assume there's going to be standardized, whether it's official or just evolves, but there's going to then be standardized sort of payment structures, you know, holiday, sick leave, all those structures, I assume, will eventually become standardized into some sort of globalized norm.
Yeah, you for sure. And I actually lived in Budapest in Hungary for 8.5 years. I left there in April. But when I first moved there versus when I left, the salaries for someone working in tech had like quadrupled. And that was entirely due to kind of upward pressure from other companies in Western Europe, Germany, the UK, these kind of places, who are hiring Hungarian developers or designers and paying them what is a low rate for the UK, but a very high rate for Hungary. And there being that kind of, I don't know what the word is, but like essentially evolving into this like bigger pool of workers where the country's border sort of stopped mattering so much from that perspective, certainly for something like, you know, graphics design or web development, where you really can do that from anywhere. If it's kind of a face-to-face sales role, some of these kind of positions might be a little bit more tricky for that to occur in.
For sure. And but as technology evolves, it's now less and less roles that can't be done remotely. Huh? Whereas, you know, before it just used to be a kernel of a few jobs, but now almost everything can be done remotely as the software and interfaces improve. It's exciting times.
Yeah. And it's only going to get, you know, more so like that. I think the jobs that cannot be done remotely are, you know, also at risk of things like automation as well. Robots and, as I said, driverless cars, these kinds of things. So the technology could kind of be assaulting it from the other end of the spectrum as well.
Absolutely. Mark Webster, thank you so much. If people want to reach out and see the work you do or know any more about you, how can they do that?
Sure. So our website is authorityhacker.com. And we have a blog on there where we talk about all things online marketing. You can go check that out. And we also have a podcast, which we do weekly episodes every Monday. So the URL for that is authorityhacker.com/podcast. We're on Facebook, Twitter, all social medias as well. So just search for Authority Hacker and you'll find us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, that was Mark Webster of Authority Hacker. If you want to get in touch with Mark or know any more about what we discussed in this episode, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/257. And as always, if you want to ask us anything, then just drop us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.